revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have one of my favorite people on, somebody who is like-minded and I feel is more than a colleague, but a real friend. We're going to speak with Dr. Ralph LaGuardia, and he is a triple specialized physician in internal medicine, geriatrics, and bariatrics. He's also an author of the Doomsday Book of Medicine and the Bible of Alternative Medicine and Infected, Secrets from the Medical Underground. And today we're going to speak about something that's near and dear to both of our hearts, and that's what it means to be a doctor in today's day, and also what it means to be a private practice doctor, because the whole healthcare system has been turned on its head. And I think Dr. Ralph and I are of the same cohort where we know what it was, what it was like, what it is now. And I think we can speak to what patients need to do to help themselves, because it's just so unwieldy at this point, Ralph, that I don't know if patients really understand that they keep going. It's like a ping pong. They keep going, being promised things that are never going to happen.
Right.
And they're in the midst of it. And I feel for them, because we at least know how to navigate the system, but I don't think the patients do. So one, welcome back to the show. And thank you for taking your time to speak with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Elaine. Yeah. Patients, unfortunately, are, you were absolutely right. It's correct term, shell-shocked. They have no idea what's going on between the insurance companies and these conglomerate hospital physician systems that control everything. The days of the primary care independent doctors like you and I are gone for the most part. In fact, in the area of Connecticut, I'm in the eastern part of Connecticut, I think there's only three or four of us left.
That's it?
Yeah, everyone else has been soaked up. And they try to absorb me all the time. They try to absorb the other guys as well. I just, you know, tell them there's no way I'm interested in doing this, you know. And I always laugh, and I tell my wife, if they hired me, they would be handcuffing me the first week and walking me out the door. So, <'cause> I'm just an independent soul, and I'm just not going to toe the party line. All I care about is my patient's welfare. I don't care about the insurance companies. I don't care about the hospital networks. In fact, I'm antagonistic towards them, because I realize what they've done to us and what they've done to medicine. I'm sorry.
Oh, I mean, I was going to ask you, when you started, what was your mindset? When I was in residency, hanging out a shingle was what we all wanted to do. That's right. Changed. What was your take on leaving residency and then going out into the real world?
Well, the interesting thing about doctors is that we have, most of us, and I can't speak for everyone, but the vast majority of us were so embedded in the medical system, climbing the medical ladder to become a physician. And we had to go through college, medical school, residencies, et cetera, that, we didn't take any business courses. We didn't do anything. And here I am running a $1.5 million business every year with no business training. And I came out of my residency very starry-eyed and looking forward to curing people and being a doctor. I was so naive. I remember meeting this girl and I was talking to her, and she said, "Why do you want to be a doctor?" And I said, "Well, besides the obvious, I want to, you know, help people. I like science and stuff." I said, "The best part, no paperwork." what planet was I on?
I don't know.
Oh my God. We have the worst paperwork job in the world. It's, you know, so when I first came out of practice, you know, I did foolish things. I joined a guy who brought me on, and he said to me, "Day 366, you're a full partner in this practice, you and me." I said, "Great." We shook hands on it. I thought I was set. Well, day 366 came, and I said, "Hey, Mike, where's that contract?" And he said, "Oh, I'm going to raise your salary. I got the lawyer working on it." He stalled me for like 6 months. Finally, I said, "Come on, what's going on here?" You know, and he said, "You know, I really don't want to share my practice with you. I want you to work for me." You know, and I said, "Well, that's not what we did." I said, "Don't you remember shaking hands on that when I first met? We discussed it, and you said day 366 you'd be a full partner." He laughed in my face and said, "Do you have it on paper?" And I said, oh, I see where this is going. Okay, you're right. I didn't. I said, you know, Mike, I said, I was a fool. I said, I just mistook you for being a man with integrity. And, you know, I, on the other hand, if, you know, if I lose money on a deal, if I shake a hand on it, that's my word. I'm old school. I'm not going to, you know, that's the way I was raised up. You know, you don't lie. You give your word on something, your word, your bond. If your word is terrible, what are you? You know, it's, you know, life, as I always say to my wife, you get knocked down many times by life. It doesn't matter how many times you're knocked down. It's how many times you get up. And, you know, that's what makes a man, and that's what makes character and stuff and perseverance. And that's what, how you win in life. And I was naive, you know, like most of us. But when I first joined private practice, it was great. It was in the beginning, even working for him, it was good. The hospital was private. It was a community hospital, and it really was a sense of community. I remember once I was making rounds on a weekend, and I got some GI bug, and I was vomiting. And there was just one other doctor, me and her, rounding, and she said, put him in a bed, give him some IV fluids, let him sleep a couple hours, you know? You know, no chart, no charge for it. You know, it was, you know, and it was a sense of congeniality and really, you know, among the physicians, it was really good. When you came to the community initially, there was a huge party welcoming you and your significant other, and every doctor came to it, every single one. You know, and they met you and you know, would talk to you and stuff. And then that would lead to a series of social events. You know, we had ski trips together. We played ball games together. There were picnics. There was all kinds of stuff that we did with the nurses and with the ancillary staff, all as one. You know, we all helped each other out. The nurses, you know, many a time a nurse saved me by not waking me up, just going, okay, I took care of that. You know, I figured you wanted to do this, you know. And I had their back, they had mine. And it was like, not just with me, it was like that with everyone. And there was a really good sense of belonging to that. And that really fostered a feeling of, I want to help people. I want to do what I've been trained to do, unleash me on them. You know, it's, and God, is that gone? The hospital's got bought out. It's gone corporate. I'll tell you a funny story. At one point, the nurses in the ICU, when it was private, had a little sign on a wall, and it said sexual harassment in big letters. And below it, it said, we'll not only be encouraged, we'll be rated. imagine now, they would arrest them. They would carry them out in handcuffs. I mean, it was a joke. They knew we weren't harassing them. You know, it was silly. We were friends, you know. But that's all gone. It's horrible. I mean, you can't, the hospital didn't charge any employee if you stayed there, no matter what your insurance, there was no bill to you. You know, they took care of you because we were the hospital.
Right.
And that's, you know, now Hartford Hospital has bought up every hospital in the area. Yale has bought the ones in the southern part of the state, or Trinity. And it's just three corporations controlling the hospitals in Connecticut. And it's not improved things. You know, everyone's feeding the mothership, Hartford Hospital or Yale, you know, from the outlying hospitals. And they've just cannibalized these hospitals and taken away OBGYN. They've taken away a lot of specialties. When I first came, we had every specialty in this little town. We had 8 orthopedic surgeons, and now we have 1. We had ENT, we had neurology, we had dermatology. We don't have any of those anymore. You know, we have to send them all somewhere else. And, you know, what a pain in the butt for patients, especially the elderly. They don't want to drive 45 minutes into a city they don't know, into Hartford or, you know, other outlying cities here to get specialty care, you know, when they used to get it right here at the hospital. And so I think in many ways, you know, in fact, I can't think of any way where it's improved.
Well, it certainly has gotten more expensive. You just described all of these different hospitals, not systems, but everybody had a personality. Like, I trained in New York. We had dozens of hospitals. They were all different.
Yeah.
Now they're all owned by maybe 2 or 3. And right. Everybody, you're right. The ER was staffed by every single specialty. I know what changed because they're asking doctors to take on more responsibility, more liability for free.
Right.
And nobody wants to do that. And this whole system, I mean, you just think about how you've gone from everybody having their own lane, being responsible for what their practice, to I'm just going to dump it in the hospital, let the hospitalists take care of it. The hospitalists don't know the patients.
Right.
It's about rounding and then going home. As soon as it's 501, they're out of there. There's no basic. I mean, they have to sign out to each other, but there's no real in-depth patient care. It's awful, but right. It's more expensive. So my question to you is why? You figure if it's volume, it should be cheaper, right? Yeah. But in every aspect, it's more expensive between the hospital fees, the facility fees, they're just ramping up costs and you don't even know where they're coming from. Why does that happen? Is it because it was corporatized?
Yes. What I think happened was the corporate hospital has an unbelievable amount of bureaucracy. I can't believe how many managers and sub-managers and assistant managers there are for everything. And there's not enough people at the tip of the spear. You know, there's not enough nurses on the floor. There's not enough nurses' aides. There's not enough physicians on the floor. You know, they skeletonize everything else to prioritize bureaucracy and to have, you know, diversity. What do you need diversity managers in there for? It's so ridiculous. I mean, Do it on competence. Do it, you know, I mean, there should be no other measure other than how good you are and how competent you are. It shouldn't matter what race you are, what your sexual orientation is, any of that nonsense. It's how good of a doctor you are. You know, it's what your outcomes are in the end. You know, and they're pushing all this nonsense. And they're, you know, they're having all these endless meetings and this, you know, just garbage. My wife worked for the hospital for years. She was a microbiologist and she finally left and said, this is crazy. You know, during COVID, they went berserk. She wasn't vaccinated and they went nuts on her. And I said, I have rheumatoid, so I'm not vaccinating her. She has Hashimoto's. She has rheumatoid arthritis. You know, SLE. I don't want this to flare on her. You know, I'm not doing it. You know, and they folded when I wrote them the letter, but you know, they still made her life miserable, you know, I'd find that it's a faceless, heartless bureaucracy.
Agree. And churning out volume for money, but not quality. It's interesting too. Don't you find that there's so many hoops to jump through, so many regulations, but the quality of care has dropped. Have you noticed that?
Oh yeah. I'm shocked how often patients say to me, I'd say, you saw the specialist, what'd he say or what'd she say? And they'll say, blah, blah, blah. And they'll say, you know, doc, he never really examined me. I'm like, what do you mean he didn't examine you? He was on his laptop the whole time. He didn't even look up. You know, he asked me a bunch of questions and just sent me on my way. You know, and I see that. I mean, you and I, we're old school. What would have happened to us in our residency if our, you know, the people supervising us heard that we saw a patient and didn't examine them? You know what I mean, it would have been the end of us.
Yeah.
Right. They would have walked us out that building. Mm-hmm. I hear it more often than not. I'm blown away by it, you know, or I'll get reports, you know, I'll say, so you were in the ER the other day with vertigo. Oh yeah, it was terrible. What happened? Well, I was there 7 hours, you know, and they did a CAT scan. They did an EEG on me. They did a 10,000 blood samples. They did everything, every test you can imagine on me. And I get this, you know, 10-page report of nonsense, you know, plus just fluff in there. Nurse gave a Tylenol at 7:08. What do I give a shit what time they gave a Tylenol? You know, get right to the chase. What happened? You know, and I'll say, well, what'd they give you? Well, they didn't give me anything. They didn't know what was causing it. They said to go see you.
Oh my gosh, that is so true.
Right. And then I look at them and I go, did they look in your ears? And they go, no. I say, you have an ear infection. That's why you're dizzy. It's the most common cause of vertigo. Are you kidding me? I see this more often than not. It drives me out of my mind.
On that note, let's take our first break. I just wanted to give people a feeling, a flavor of what it's like on the front line. So let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Ralph LaGuardia. And what you described before the break is maddening because the patients they don't know. All they know is they come in with a complaint and they're getting $1 million workup. I'm an ENT and I can't tell you the amount of times that people came in with a sore throat to the ER. Instead of doing something clinically, they'd order a CT scan for a peritonsillar abscess. Right. Really? That's a clinical diagnosis and treatment. Okay, I can see you can call an ENT consult, but a CT?
Right.
How many thousands of dollars are, you're right, added to this fluff And is it because they're trying, I mean, the party line is they're trying not to get sued. So it's like a CYA type of thing. But on the corporate side, you have to follow the money, don't you? Every time a test is ordered, that's more money for the hospital.
Yes, that's what they want. They want us to order. And in fact, there was a couple of years ago, there was a little uprising on our staff by the internists because we said radiology is not helping us. Every time we send people for a test, there's no definitive diagnosis. They always recommend other tests. Oh, wow. We're in this endless loop of MRIs and ultrasounds and CAT scans. Do you have any idea what you're doing? Where are we going with this? You know, can't you tell me what's going on? And they're afraid to commit to it without following up with something else.
Wow. And that's the ones that are in-house, but now there's a movement towards outsourcing everything. Mm. So you do your scan, but it's being read by a doctor somewhere else, maybe not even in the country, because it's all about the bottom line and saving money. And right. I wonder, and I think you can answer this question too, are you really saving money by doing a $1 billion workup instead of having or calling a consult because you don't have time to do the physical examination? Does that really serve the patient? And for all the naysayers that say how expensive the healthcare system is, do you think it would be cheaper if we just got rid of all of these ancillary, I wouldn't say they're specialties, but there's so many layers before the doctor sees the patient that it's just costing, it's the least trained in terms of time on the front line now. That was never the case before.
Yeah, it was the exact opposite before, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the old saying, common things are common. You know, in medicine, you know, you hear hoofbeats, don't think zebra, it's a horse. You know, there's, and they think zebra all the time. They go to this elaborate, and I'm thinking, what are you doing? You know, first treat, you know, look in your ear. If they don't have an ear infection, then maybe start looking for other stuff. But God, you know, I'd say 90% of them you could just eliminate with that. You want to do a CBC, fine. You want to show off, but you know, you don't even need that. You know, and what do we do in private practice? You know, people like us, we go right to the chase. Boom, boom. I mean, I have patients that come in, new patients. I invariably hear the same thing from them. God, you did more for me in a 15-minute visit than the last guy did in 10 years. You mean, well, woman, you know, you didn't, you know, they didn't tell me anything. They didn't show me what to do. They didn't put their hands on me. And, you know, I'd say, do you hear this heart murmur? No. I said, really? It's, you know, 2 to 3/6. I can't believe the guy didn't hear it, you know? Uh-huh. And it's just endless, just there's patients being led down this path of just endless testing and, you know, and endless medications for simple things that could easily be eliminated, especially me because I'm a functional medicine doctor.
Exactly. So, I was just going to ask you, if people trained to know nutrition and to understand cellular biology, would we have so many medications prescriptions written? And every time I listen to something on TV, the side effect is the worst. I mean, it's death, it's suicidal ideation. It's terrible. Right. Why is stuff on the market? So if we could go back to basics, do you think that would make a difference? And I think we have to talk about medical education, don't we? Because it's changed dramatically.
Yeah, I went to medical school in Italy. It was a lot different than here. It was very hands-on. It was, you know, our professors were, it was oral exams in Italian, in front of professors who were gods. They weren't our buddies. You know, and then you got one thing wrong after an hour. They didn't lower your grade. They threw you out and said, come back in 6 months. You know, they were hardcore. But at the end of the day, we were trained not to rely on technology. You better examine a patient and, you know, we had a whole course just in topographical anatomy. You know, I went to the school I went to, Padua, is the home of anatomy. Fallopio was there, Morgani, all these famous anatomists. And, you know, they didn't rely on technology at all. They said, you better be able to feel this and look for that first. You know, first examine the patient thoroughly. First get a history, actually, and then examine them thoroughly. And then, as you know, 90% of your answers are almost there, or at least we will develop a hypothesis of what we think it is.
Mm-hmm. And then use the modality to confirm what you already came up with your hypothesis.
Right. Not to shotgun it and order every test in the world and hope one of them hits. You know, and I think that the medical schools are just not training doctors the way they should, the way they used to. first of all, I think that there should be functional medicine, a course in functional medicine there, because that teaches young doctors how to integrate anatomy and physiology together. Yeah, you know I mean, and then with nutrition. And then they can realize, because as you know, so many illnesses are there because of dysfunction. The, you know, the thyroid or the heart or the lung is not functioning properly, and because it's not getting what it needs to function properly. And so once I replete those things, and an amazing number of illnesses go away, because they're not really illnesses, they're deficiencies. And once you correct them, you don't need pharmaceuticals, which don't correct them. They just mask the symptoms. And so all you're doing is hiding what the problem is. You're not getting to correcting the problem. Until they get back to teaching that, which they don't do, there is, you know, I always have this fantasy because I write my Substack column, the Medical Underground, and there every week I cover a different topic. I always fantasize that some medical school is going to see this and go, man, we should just give this to our students and have them read this. But, you know, they don't know. And then on top of it, when, you know, we're old enough to know that when we were in our residencies, I was first a surgical resident. I mean, I graduated medical school on a Thursday, Tuesday morning, I was doing open heart surgery in Pittsburgh. You know, it was hardcore. And our schedule was 110 hours a week. You know,
those days. Yeah.
Remember those? Mm-hmm. You know, 3 days on, 1 day off. And you're single, you party the day you're off. You know, but it was grueling, and certainly, you know, from the outside viewed as inhumane and accident prone. However, on the inside, we got 3 years experience in 1 year. And as you know, when you're terrified in the middle of the night and a patient's going south and it's just you and the resident or you and the intern, you learn a hell of a lot. You know, sure. We were trained to stay with them. There was no shifts. Our shift is over. They would laugh in our face. Shift is over. Get back there. The patient's still sick. You know, where do you think you're going? You know, but these new guys, 40-hour week, how much could they get in 3 years?
Nothing. I mean, by the time you pass it to the next person, you don't get to see how the disease process unfolds.
Right.
What decisions you made affect the outcome. You don't get to see any of that.
Right.
But plus, there's no pride in this, though. It's already this victim mentality. I'm put upon. You're not treating me well. You're not speaking to me like I want to be spoken. I mean, it's just
right.
A lot.
Yeah, you're disrespecting me. It's nonsense.
It's about the patient. It's already become about the person instead of what we're all there for, which is to perform patient care.
Exactly. And in addition to which, I have not fond memories, but vivid memories of dying patients and staying at their bedside and holding their hand and stroking their head and trying to comfort them a little bit and administering things to them, you know, as you did as well. And, you know, I mean, crying with them. I'm not afraid, you know, I'm not ashamed to say it. You know, they broke my heart, some of them. You know, I'm tearing up and talking to them, saying, I remember one guy, a young black guy, dying cystic fibrosis, I'm blanking out on there. Anyway, he was dying, and I stayed with him all night. He goes, I don't want to die. I said, I don't want you to die. But, you know, he eventually expired. But he goes, I don't want to be alone. I said, I'm not leaving. I'll stay here all night with you, you know. And I did until he died. But, you know, I think that you know, it molded us as doctors. It gave us empathy. It gave us, you know, we know what patient pain is about. We know what their suffering is about. And you know, and we know that in our heart of hearts, that's why we became doctors, to alleviate that suffering and to help them and correct the problems. I mean, no greater feeling than someone come into my office sick as a dog and leaving feeling better because of something I administered there or what I'm doing. And I'm sure the same with you. And that's what feeds us. That's what I live for, you know, in helping people. And that I don't see that in a lot of them. A lot of young guys don't seem to be, they don't have the fire in their belly we had.
No, but you realize when it's about time, right? We had the time. You took the time to be with the patient, to be their support, to empathize. There's no time. Was it 7 minutes on average?
Right.
That a doctor spending time with the patient. Everybody's come before them. They're signing off or writing a prescription.
Right.
And you're right. They're not laying hands on anybody. So the pathway to healthcare, in my opinion, is empathy. And yes. You can't do it in a minute. You have to actually have time. I want to discuss with you, I'm going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I want to start the conversation is, how do we get there? Somebody gave in, and the doctors are, to me, they're complicit in this. Because if we had empathy, there's no way we would have let somebody come in and say, you need to see 50 patients a day and like it.
Right.
And get them in and get them out and do this procedure because we want the bottom line. Somebody had to be the adult in the room and say no. And that's where I think private practice and people who've gone into the system, I think that's one of our divisions where I'm not doing it. I don't care what you say. I'm never going to do that. I won't join your system. Right. If we had done that en masse, I don't believe we'd be sitting here saying or having this conversation. Do you?
No, I agree. You know, the powers that be in medicine let us down big time.
Yeah, but who? These are the same folks who are our mavens, aren't they? Yeah, these are the academic doctors who are getting a check from a different side, not from the patient, but from the hospital or from big pharma. So your allegiance, your fiduciary responsibility stopped being to the patient and it became to your institution.
Right.
I think that's the major problem.
Yeah, I think you hit it.
I think also, but I know we're going to take a break, but I want to ask you about your thoughts of evidence medicine, because to me, that was the tent that got put up that everything went under. If it's evidence-based medicine, then it's God, right?
Yeah,
you need
right.
to follow that. And as an independent doctor, correct me if I'm wrong, but we see things empirically. You're actually able to see a patient making a decision that's not just algorithm driven, have a great outcome, and then apply that. That disappears in this system, doesn't it?
Yes. You want to take a break or you want me to
expand on that? Let's take our break. Alan. Come back. Let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. I took the break right at the time that I was trying to make a point. And for our listeners, if people don't understand what evidence-based medicine is, because that was the buzzword when I left residency. It was the thing that was involved with capitation and standardization and, to me, the linchpin of corporatization of medicine, because you could cookbook it. And
yes.
It was given more power than thinking and from, you know, to being a doctor, which is about individualized healthcare. So what's your take on evidence-based medicine? And do you think that's one of the main reasons that we're in this situation now as well?
Yes, I fully agree with you. What evidence-based medicine does is it makes it robotic. It makes it cookbook, just like you said. If patient comes in with A, you give them B. You know, and don't think about it. There's no other options there. It eliminates experience. It eliminates the nuances of medicine, the practice of medicine, the art of it. The art of it is to listen to your patients, to hear. I always backtrack and go, no, when did this first start? What was the first thing you felt? Where was your first problem? And then I come forward from there, because as we were trained, the history is everything first. You know, just come in, you know, patients are unreliable at best and given historical stuff. So you got to kind of pull it out of them, but it's there. The only information is there. You just have to have the time to do it, you know, and the patience to do it. But when you do that, you track it down and then you apply, you know, your experience to it, you know, and then you apply the things that we know don't work in medicine, which are a lot of them, and the things we know that work marvelously, you know. And so, you know, as a private practice doctor, a private practitioner, especially seasoned ones like us, that means old, but we have the experience and evidence-based medicine negates the application of that experience.
I couldn't have said it better. But who came up with it? It wasn't doctors, was it? Was it big pharma? Because it's always got a medication associated with it. Have you noticed?
Yes. And also it enables ancillary PAs and nurse practitioners and stuff who have a very small knowledge base compared to us, but it allows them to survive in a niche where they just do A equals B, blah, 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 and can plug in and go along. And not feel okay about it, you know. And I know that from doctors who I've met who were PAs before, nurse practitioners before, and said, God, I thought I knew everything. They go, oh my God, before I went to medical school, I can't believe it now, how little, and it's not to put them down. A lot of them are very good in the niche that they're in. It's great. But I think evidence-based medicine, they fit that corporate model really good. And what you're seeing is ERs with one doctor and six PAs or nurse practitioners in there, you know, and one doctor on it's much cheaper to have the, you know, one doctor in there and have, and the oversight's not great. I mean, they dictate the note and make it sound like, you know, I reviewed everything they said, and you and I know that really isn't happening, you know, and I think physicians are foolish allowing that to happen, because they're going to eventually, you know, especially with AI coming in, they're eventually going to say, you know, that computer is way better than you at this. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't really need a doctor for this. Let's have, you know, AI assisted, you know, ancillary, you know, nurses or physician assistants do this first. And if it doesn't work out, we'll send them to the doctor. And I think that's where we're heading. And I think that's a dangerous path. And I think it doesn't serve patients well. And I've seen so many mistakes that were so obvious that I'm looking at who looked at you, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, it's very disappointing. And I think, you know, patients are confused by it too. They constantly describe so-and-so as a doctor. And I always correct them. I'm not, that's a PA. That's not a doctor. You know, because I just don't want that physician title to be watered down, to be given to anyone, you know, that patients see. I don't think it's fair to us. We went to school many, many years and trained, very vigorously trained, to get that title.
Exactly. And there's a doctor of everything now. So doctor doesn't mean anything. You really have to go MD, DO, or whatever your training, your certificate is, in order to delineate yourself from the rest of the healthcare system.
Right.
And, you know, it started off about money, but ultimately didn't it not derive from the insurance model, because they stopped paying people for their worth. They started nickel and diming people.
Yes.
So doctors were paid you're paid a fraction, 10% of what your bill was, which is ridiculous. Right. But right. Everything in private practice, for example, has gone up. Your malpractice, your cost of doing business. This is the only profession where you don't get a paid consistent with inflation. That's a joke.
I think we're off 20% for Medicare from 15 years ago. They haven't raised the rate. They're talking about cutting them.
No, they have.
Yeah, where our overhead is crazily high now compared to then, especially for salaries, you know, and they're crushing us, and you know, and they wonder why primary care is dying off. First of all, it's the hardest, because my best friend's a cardiologist, and I always give him a hard time. I call him a one organ doctor. his face gets red every time. I go, Joe, I'm a real doctor. I do the whole body and the mind. You know, but there's, you know, no, so yeah, so specialties, we need them, and they're great. But primary care is brutally hard. I mean, just look at the PDR. We have to know the entire friggin' PDR, and everything's got two names to make it worse. Yeah. So, I mean, it couldn't be worse of a nightmare for us, but, and there's a lot of responsibility there, but people don't want to do it. It's easier to go into a specialty, and a lot of them do it because they love that specialty. I'm not putting down specialists by any means, but I'm just saying primary care is in trouble because of that. And I think eventually it's going to be a little fiefdoms with a doctor over a hierarchy at the head of PAs and nurse practitioners. And,
oh, it's already happening though.
Yeah.
We've got this whole telemedicine. We even talked about telemedicine, how that's been outsourced. I just want to know your take on this. I know what I think, but what is telemedicine? That's not healthcare. How do you diagnose somebody? You don't touch them. You can't really do a physical examination.
Right.
It's minutes on the phone. And all you end up doing is writing a prescription. And that became standard under the whole pandemic time frame, and I thought it would go away, but it's actually expanded.
It's institutionalized now, and patients are used to it. You know, I mean, I probably do 6 or 8, even 10 telemedicine calls a day, but I don't like it. But you know, patients can't come in for whatever reason, and quite frankly, these were things I was doing before, calling in stuff for them and not getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
So now I go, okay, fine. I'll charge you for it. I'm doing the same thing anyway. I might as well, you know, you don't make a lot of money on telemedicine, but you make a few bucks. It was better get paid for what I was doing, especially in light of the financial crunch they've got us under, you know. But I think the only specialty that telemedicine works in is psychiatry.
Agreed. I would agree absolutely with that.
Yeah.
But it's not, but you're doing telemedicine for your patients. That's a completely different ballgame than someone calling 1-800-DOC.
Right.
Getting somebody who's, you know, not even within the specialty, making diagnoses of ear infections and all sorts of things that you're not even looking in the ear. How do you even know what it is?
Right.
Urinary tract infection, maybe you might be able to get that because it's pretty clear, right, or yeast infection. But what happens when it's subtle and it's actually a tumor and actually it's referred pain to the ear and it's really all these other subtleties that just get passed over? And I haven't seen any study, and I wonder if you have, of the consequences of this conveyor belt medicine. How many diagnoses are missed? How many patients end up in the ICU or dead because of misdiagnoses based on convenience?
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. I think that I don't know of any study either, but you know, just like you, I mean, my assumption is that it's not worked out very well. But I think once again, you hit it right on the head. I mean, it's the follow the money. It's much cheaper for an insurance company to have you do telemedicine than to have you do an office visit. You know, and they know you're not, you know, there's no lab work involved. There's no x-rays. There's no CAT scans. There's no EKGs and nothing else. You know, and patients, unfortunately, you know, they're like Amazon. Amazon's wiping out retail because we're all guilty of it. You know, it's so easy. Just, you know, 10 o'clock at night, you want to read that book, order it, it's in your house the next day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, yeah. And I think that's the same kind of model with corporate medicine and with telemedicine. And then you have things like CVS, you know, these little med clinics that they have in there with a nurse, you know, that's all. That kills primary care, that stuff. That's our bread and butter, all those little things, you know. And then you have all these online things. You call up for your ED meds. You call up for this. You call up, you know. It, once again, it slowly picks away at the things we do every day, you know. And so I don't know what they're going to do eventually, but it's going to make it harder and harder for private guys and gals like us to survive in this environment, you know, and it's not going to end pretty. I don't know how it's going to end, but I think they'll eventually have the pendulum will swing back and they'll say this isn't working so well and we'll only do certain diagnoses. We're not going to do chest pain or, you know, with a telemedicine visit, you know, patients try to do now. I had women try to do that today.
Really?
Yeah. I'm sweating like a pig. I'm like, God, I'm having a hard time breathing in my chest. I said, I can't treat you by phone. You got to come in, you know, actually admitted her. I sent her to the hospital after I saw her. You know, her EKG was off, and you know, I said, no. Your blood pressure is 190 over 120. There's something wrong here. You know, I said, I've rechecked it. I've watched you. I said, you're going down. I said, your EKG doesn't look great. It's changed a little bit. I don't have your cardiac enzymes back, but you're going to the hospital. You know, but many times I sent patients to the hospital, and they watch them and don't admit them. I'm like, God, I can't believe they sent you home with this.
Oh, that's that's crazy at what's going on from that standpoint too. It's like the ERs are just designed to send them to an outpatient referral, right? So right. I'll give you an appointment. I don't even give you an appointment. They just tell you to go see an ENT or go see a urologist or whatever. And then the patient's on the hook for finding somebody, and that's months down the road.
Right. Right.
I wonder, this is another question that needs to be answered about liability. There is no liability here. It's like the insurance companies are practicing medicine. The people who are on the telemedicine end and the insurance companies that push that, because some people have to see do telemedicine and not see the individual, the doctor.
Yeah, right, right.
What happens if there's a bad outcome? Who's getting sued for this?
It's true. I often wonder it because I'm old school. I have paper charts, believe it or not. I dictate remotely to a place in Georgia. They type it up and send it back, and then we scan it and put it in the computer. But I'm not sitting there with a laptop. My notes are dictated, and it's like me speaking to you. And you know, it's not a template. Mm-hmm. You know, for ENT, for example, I just recently saw a note from them. And in the template, They talked about the cardiac exam, the lungs. They didn't touch any of this. Why, you know, why is this even in here? I mean, aren't they embarrassed? You know, it was a couple pages of stuff. I know they didn't do. I know you looked at the head, you know, and the ears and the throat, and that's fine. I know you did that. I know you didn't do the other stuff, you know. And I thought, I think, what a liability trap that is. You know, I mean, you know, a good lawyer could be, really, did you look at the, do you always listen to the lungs? You're, you know, doing an abdominal exam and check the pulses in your feet? I don't think so. You know, and that's the same reason why I don't, I tried in the past not to do too much telemedicine. I definitely don't have patients email me anything. I don't allow it. And the reason is, what would happen if you emailed me tonight and said, Dr. White, I'm having crushing chest pain. What should I do? And I don't pick up my email. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's a liability trap of traps. You know, well, doctor, why are you giving out your email if you're not checking it, you know, in a timely fashion, you know, and it's all on us. You know, as you know, lawyers love to prey on us with that stuff.
That's a given.
Yeah, and I'm amazed that they haven't done the using the computer template as you know, to take apart a specialist.
Wow. Well, let's take our last break and come back, because there's so many things that we need as physicians to withdraw our consent from, I think. You're right. Most of it's a trap, and it doesn't serve us or the patient. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. And Dr. LaGuardia, how can people buy your books and go to your Substack? Because as you said, you write blogs which are extremely helpful on how we can take care of ourselves and get to know our own bodies and be our own physician. That's what it's going to come down to.
Yeah. If you go to Substack, you go to medicalunderground.substack.com. That'll bring you right to the Medical Underground, which is me. And you'll see the archives there. I've got probably 150 articles on there on every aspect, you know, and I try to put very helpful things on there for patients, basic things, fever, the importance of fever, not treating it, you know, letting it burn and different things like that, hydration, you know, different foods I'll cover, nutritional stuff, you know, things like that. This week I wrote one on allulose, which is a sugar substitute. That's fabulous. You know, and I try to do things that my patients and my readers can employ in their lives. And I know they are, because I get such great feedback from all over the world, basically, of how, you know, one article I wrote changed them because they incorporated this into their healthcare. But it's very reader accessible. You don't have to be a physician. You don't have to have any medical experience or knowledge to read my article. I whenever I use a term, I immediately in parentheses right next to it what it means, so you don't get lost in jargon. And a lot of times I'll take a deep dive into the science, but I'll keep those sections walled off, and I'll say, kinky fact, you know, nerd food, don't read this section unless you really love science. Skip to the next one if you don't like it, you know. But by the same token, I want to educate patients. I want it to be both entertaining and educational for them, and so they could read it and go, oh, okay, I understand that. And I don't just tell them, in my books the same thing, I don't just tell you, okay, this is you know, a heart attack, this I tell you, or this is high blood pressure. I give you ways to treat it, you know, without pharmaceuticals, because there's so many interventions you can do, as you know, that are just over-the-counter things that work just fine to prevent or treat a lot of stuff and that the public doesn't know about and is really hungry for this kind of stuff.
Well, I think this is really the essence of being a physician. It's a teacher, honestly.
Right.
You know, it's about having your patient be a partner in their care, not pronouncing on high, do it this way, or I'm going to remove you as a patient. I mean, it should never be adversarial. And if it is, I think patients have to take now really good care of themselves and take responsibility. If you've got a little feeling and you're in a physician or practitioner's office, find another one. The only way that people are going to get change, in my opinion, is you got to withdraw your pocketbook and your consent.
They only
understand money and volume.
Right.
And right now it makes it sound like it's the only game in town. You have to take a prescription. You have to go through these hoops. Otherwise you'll never have your health back.
Right.
And you and I are here to say that there's plenty of ways to stay healthy. your blog is one, and I read it myself. It's great, and I share it with my patients.
Oh, you do great. Thank you.
Of course. I mean, you're doing yeoman's work, and you're doing it for the love of the patient, and that's the right energy. And I love patients who want to be their own partner in their care, who want to take care of themselves, who want to take personal responsibility. Those are the best patients to treat and to care for, because they're going to go the extra mile to get better. And you get to discharge them, which is what we're supposed to do, right? Not see the same person, same thing for the same reason over and over again. I don't find that interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, as one patient described to me, she said, "You never give up on me." She goes, "No matter what comes up," she said, "you always find something, or you'll scour and come up with something to try it." And they appreciate that. But what I tell patients all the time, and patients have this odd thing, I'm sure you've heard this all the time. They go, "I didn't want to bother you," you know. And I said, "Listen to me." I said, if patients that need help bothers me, I'm in the wrong profession. I mean, my God, I said, you're not here to serve me. I'm here to serve you. You know, it's not my convenience. It's for your health and what's important. I said, don't ever think you're bothering me, you know, by calling up or coming in too often or whatever, you know. But I also don't browbeat them. You know, I give them their options, you know, like smoking cessation, you know, we all push that. And when I do it, and they'll say, "Oh, doc, I like to smoke." I said, "Listen, you're a big boy. You do what you want. I'm not here to beat you up." I said, "But I'm just telling you, this is the stuff that's going to get you." You know, I said, or, you know, older man will come in and I'll say, "Look, we got to check your prostate. We got to do a colonoscopy on you or a Cologuard test. We have to do these things." I said, "Because this is low hanging fruit." I said, "You feel good now, but if we don't check these things, this is stuff that's going to take you out in your age group. And so I want to take that off the table, and then we can relax about things and not be so vigilant. But I said, you got to work with me on these little ones. You know, we got to do this." And I think they appreciate that.
I'm sure they do. Yeah. I mean, you must have the most, you know, when you leave for the day, I know you're tired, but you must feel like I made a difference.
Oh, I do. I do. And, you know, I run a nursing home as well. And I get my wife is like, "Why do you do that?" It's 88 beds and currently 85 of them are my patients. It's like having a small hospital. But I love the old people. I go there and I round on them once a month. You don't have to. You're supposed to do it every 90 days, you know, minimum, but I do it every month. And there are some that I know get no visitors. And I'll sit down with them. I'll spend 5 minutes talking to them. Just, "Hey, how are things?" You know, blah, blah, blah. And they'll tell me stories of the past. And their eyes just light up. And they, "Oh, doc, thank you. Don't worry about it. I'll see you next month." You know, and, you know, it just makes all the difference. Because imagine how lonely they are. They're lonely. Their family hasn't shown up. They've been parked there for years. And, you know, the same thing I always do, even in my practice. I kiss the old lady. I hug everyone. I'm very affectionate to everyone. And okay, I'm sure someday someone will come back to bite me, but I'm not going to be one of those cold guys who, you know, I always say, "Give me a hug." And they go, "Okay." You know, I don't paw them or anything, you know, but you know, I think that's part of our role. Part of, you know, why not? I'm their doctor. I want, you know, I'm friends with 85% of my patients probably. You know, I like them. I know all about them. I know things about them their spouse doesn't know. You know, and they're, you know, I've taken care of them for decades. And, you know, that's why, you know, people say, "Why don't you retire? You'll be 71 this year." I said, "What am I going to do? I like these. What are these people going to do without me?" You know? Yeah, they always go, "Doc, are you going to retire?" And, you know, I reassure them. They go, "What am I going to do without you?" I said, "Oh, you are so screwed." I tell them, "I'm not really old. I just look bad."
Well, from the standpoint of the private doctor, how do we turn our colleagues on to withdrawing themselves from this system? I've seen so much burnout. There's the suicide rate among physicians. They don't talk about that very much, but it's extremely high.
Very high, especially among young ones.
Yeah. I mean, in training even. So I've never heard of that.
And me either.
You're working less than we were doing 100 hours a week.
Right.
Being browbeaten by our professors.
Yeah, they weren't our buddies.
No. But we made it through and we had purpose. What's going on, do you think, in this situation that people just feel they've lost their way? And
yeah, I think
worth living, that's tragic. Yeah.
I know. I don't know how to fix it, really. I think on an individual basis, I've always fantasized about having some guy come out of medical school and call me up and go, you know, I really want to be a functional medicine doctor. I want to learn how to do this stuff. And, you know, God, well, I would be happy as happy could be, you know, to have someone I could teach this stuff to. But, you know, they don't seem to be there. And a lot of them just want to put in that 40 hours and go home, you know. And you know, I don't, like I said, I don't see the fire in their belly about stuff, you know.
No.
I have my cousin's stepson. He went to medical school. I never thought he had a fire in his belly, but the kid had wisely bought some Bitcoin a while back, and he's never practiced. And he came out of medical school. He's wealthy from Bitcoin and just retired. And they thought that was great, you know, and I always thought that was horrible. And they said, why? And they say he could do what he wants. I said, but he took the place of a guy who had a fire in his belly, who could be seeing patients right now and helping them instead of sitting there in the sports car driving around with, you know, Bitcoin millionaire and not doing shit with his life or not helping anyone. You know, I said, that's the part they don't understand because they're not doctors. We know when we went to medical school, and the happiest day of your life when you got your doctorate, you know, and, you know, your MD degree, you know, you worked 15, you know, 12 years to get there. And then finally they bestow it on you. And, you know, I remember I was like choked up. I was like, oh, finally, you know, I've made it here. And because it was something I always wanted and something you always wanted. And that fire drove us through all the trials and tribulations and the 100-hour weeks and stuff, knowing at the end of that, we would be in private practice and we would be our own masters, our own destiny, and take things on. And I'm hoping the pendulum swings back. You know, I'm not
optimistic.
I'm not optimistic. No.
I would say that I don't want to wait for the pendulum. I want to create my, and as you are, create your own path. We don't need a ton of doctors to opt out of the system. We need a steady number, and we need to educate our patients that there's a better way. That's, I think, how the system breaks. When people can look at their colleague, their family member who's thriving, not getting robbed and ripped off every time they go to get a procedure done if they need one.
Right.
And say, you know, I didn't know idea that this wasn't really the cost of X. And if I had paid cash, it would have been a fraction. Or if I'd gone to a functional medicine doctor, I would actually be able to talk to the doctor and get treatment in a way that syncs with how I feel, as opposed to me just going along and being miserable and not getting the result that I want. I think it's going to have to be a show and prove type of situation, because I don't think that the Congress is not going to work for us.
Yeah.
The government doesn't work for the healthcare system is driven by the same people who want the status quo.
Right.
They could care less what doctors want. How many times have you called to get something pre-certed and you know that it's appropriate and you get poo-pooed, or worse yet, they tell you can do it, and then they deny it after you've done it.
Right.
It's a complete scam.
I know. It was funny because I called Arizona to get something pre-approved, and I'm talking to this doctor there, and I said, and he goes, "This is Dr. Gottlieb, blah, blah, blah." And I said, "You don't sound like you're from Arizona." And he goes, "I'm from New Jersey." I said, "Where?" And he goes, "Englewood." I said, "Ron Gottlieb?" He goes, "Ralph?" Yeah, he goes, I go, "There's not many LaGuardias. There's a ton of Gottliebs. Come on, you didn't think it was me?" Hey, we ran track together in high school, and then he went to medical school. It was hilarious. I said, wow. But I think I had this fantasy as well. I got a lot of fantasies, but I have this fantasy that a wise insurance company, a smaller one, that would realize the cost savings of instituting a functional medicine program and among their patients, paying for it and having, you know, even me train a bunch of you know, PAs or whatever, an army of, you know, if we couldn't get physicians to do it, just to apply these things, make sure everyone's vitamin D level is good right off the bat, you know, around, do mass screenings for fasting glucoses, check that out, put them on some vitamin C also. You know, depends what their disease is, put them on the appropriate minerals that they need, you know, and do things like that first. And then see, I think it would be an amazing cost savings for them.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and I think once they realize that they would have better outcomes, that would be the stuff we use is no side effects to, except beneficial stuff. I'm just giving nutrients to the body and stuff the body recognizes, organic stuff. You know, I'm not putting in these chemicals. I mean, I've had patients come in with, and I'm sure you have as well, 30, 35 prescriptions.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I look at them and they're sick as sick can be. And I said to them, you know something, half your problem is polypharmacy. And they go, what do you mean? I said, these meds are interacting with each other. I said, you're taking in 35 chemicals every day. You don't think there's a price for that? And I said, listen, you know, if you want to do this, I said, we can do this. I said, I'm going to cut you down to 5 or 6. These are the ones I think are essential right now for you. You know, I said, if we need more, we'll add them back in. And I've only done this maybe a dozen times, but every time it's worked out great. Every single time.
Not surprised at all.
Yeah, they come in, they go, oh my God, I was under a cloud. I was drugged all day, you know, and half their problems go away. You know, but that's, you know, once again, for us, that's a liability trap. You know, you got to make sure they sign off on it. You understand that we're doing this. It's not the standard of care that we would normally do. You know, that standard of care nonsense is terrible because the standard sucks.
Exactly.
And that's what they hold us to. You're like, okay, you're holding us to a model that doesn't work.
No.
You know?
And I applaud you for staying the course, honestly. And your patients are blessed to have you.
Yours as well.
Oh, thank you. You know, time goes way too quickly. And I have to come back, because this is just a tutorial for our patients to understand the bigger picture. Hopefully they'll take this and run with it.
My hope is there's a pharmaceutical rep, a company owner out there, an insurance company, who's listening to this and, you know, maybe we should try that. You know?
They can make a lot of money the right way.
Yes. And have better outcomes.
Exactly. By delivering patient care.
And they won't be executed by lone gunmen because these crazy guys. Yeah. We were just trying to get back at them because everyone's pissed at the insurance companies. I mean, I don't know anyone who's happy with them.
No, yeah. I don't either, whether they're healthy or unfortunately have an illness. No,
by the way, not that I'm advocating shooting them. I'm not saying anything like that. That's a sicko guy out there, you know, but just the fact that people are driven to that. And look at he's cloud sourcing and he's got millions of dollars of people sending in to help him. Mm-hmm. Are you kidding me? You know?
There's a better way. Right. We just discussed it for an hour. So I know that time is short, but I want to make sure people know, again, how to get to your Substack, buy your books.
Yep. It's medicalunderground.substack, substack.com. Or you can go to Amazon. All my books are on there. The Infected Secrets from the Medical Underground. What that is, it's a handbook of how to treat every infection from head to toe without pharmaceuticals. And quite successfully, especially things like COVID. I was treating that with nebulized hydrogen peroxide and a whole bunch of different nutraceuticals with fabulous outcomes. And then there's the Bible of Alternative Medicine, which is probably an integrative handbook for alternative medicine. And then there's the Doomsday Book of Medicine, which is 900 pages. That's a handbook for preppers, really, for the most part, and really how to treat every problem you can think of without pharmaceuticals. And once again, I give you 20 different ways to do it. So it's not, you're not locked into anything, but stuff you can readily acquire without a prescription.
Love it. Thank you so much for joining me today. I can't wait to have you back on.
Anytime you want. Thank you for having me, Elena. I always enjoy talking to you.
Right back at you. And thank you everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.